previously on Unsolved. Acker claimed three men picked up Joe at McDonald's, and when they did, John was in the back seat. Then they drove to Whitnall Park, where John tried to run away. So then Joe caught John, and the other men assaulted John and killed him.
So you think Joe did this?
No, I think Joe was a helper. And the reason he used mental patients is because you can't take him to court.
Acker would take his theory about Joe the patient to John's family, including his older brother Mark, and to the police, and ultimately to the media.
This was to have been the end of our series, The Zerophile. However, a few weeks ago, a man approached the Zeras, claiming to have information from a source who may have been in Whitnall Park when John Zera died.
For Schoonover and other detectives today, Acker remains this confusing piece of the puzzle. We know now that crimes like this will be revisited by the perpetrator. It's their way of reliving it and continuing to derive pleasure from it. But what does Acker's strange behavior mean for cops like Schoonover decades later?
I still think he's an extremely viable suspect in this case. And we're going to see where that goes.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. Daniel Acker wasn't the only suspect in the murder investigation of 14-year-old John Zera. For decades, investigators believed another man might be responsible for the crime. Michael Yaporsky was a substitute teacher and part-time hall monitor at Franklin High School back in 1976. And when the police did their initial canvas of all the teachers and students at the school, he told them that most likely he was on his lunch break, alone with his newspaper at the time that John went missing. Police also requested a list of every full-time male employee at the school. Remember, the FBI profiler at the time told them they were looking for a gay or bisexual man. For those of you who are new to our podcast, Detective Kent Schoonover took over the investigation into John's death in 2001, and he'd work on it on and off until he retired. Here's Schoonover talking to my class at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee about the list of male employees that police asked for from Franklin High School.
The Franklin Police Department requested from the Franklin High School a list of all males associated with the high school in 1976. Teachers, staff, anybody at all, substitutes, anybody that came in, coaches from other teams, anybody at all that had any connection with the high school, as long as it was a male, they wanted that information. We get this list, or the Franklin and Hales Corners Police Department get this list from the Franklin High School, and they go through the list, and remarkably, there's a name missing.
Nobody knows for sure why Mike Yaporsky's name was not on the list that the principal gave the investigators early on in the investigation. One of the cops back in the day theorized that it was because he was a part-time employee. But in fact, he wasn't a part-time employee. Even though he was a substitute, he was a full-time substitute who was in the school every day. And he helped coach the girls' basketball team. So nobody really knows for sure if it was an oversight or if someone on purpose left his name off the list. Because of that omission, Yaporsky's arrest record would go unchecked for years. Yaporsky didn't really hit the police radar until they received an anonymous tip from a woman, kind of cluing them into some of the strange behavior in his past. The woman said she had heard a disturbing rumor at a Christmas party, but she wasn't sure of the details about Yaporsky, and she didn't want her name used, and she didn't want to get involved with the investigation. And so that's when Norm Pullman, who was the Franklin police chief at the time, went back and looked at the list, realized Yaporsky's name was not on it, and then started looking into his background. As a juvenile and up until his teens and very early 20s, Mike Yaporsky had been arrested a few times and had some contact with the police due to actions that he would take with boys. when he was a kid, the boys were a little bit younger than him, but then as he got into his late teens, they were about the same age. And his history includes finding these boys and accosting them, taking off their shoes and socks, and playing with their feet. Here's what Yaporsky said about those incidents years later when he was questioned by police working on John's case in 2001.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of your early contacts with law enforcement in the late 60s, which resulted in your being arrested in the city of West Dallas, Greenfield, etc.?
Sure, I went through some medical rehab for that. I guess it was stress and related, uncalled for behavior, happened in Molotosa, I think in West Dallas.
Right.
And went to court on it and then was assigned a county, I think it was county, the old county hospital based in psychiatric treatment.
Yeah.
And then went through 6 or 8 months over there, and then something was traumatic, court met them up the last,
okay,
I heard of it.
Back in the 60s, when Mike Yaporsky had these interactions with the police were very focused on trying to help him because he didn't beat up the boys, didn't molest the boys, and there was no indication that any of this was done for sexual gratification. So although it was strange and it was disorderly conduct, it wasn't a serious crime. So in juvenile court, they were very focused on trying to get him help and figuring out why he was doing this and what they could do to help him stop. So he did receive some therapy and counseling about how to overcome these compulsions to play with boys' feet. My understanding was that back in the 70s, schools were not as diligent as they are now about running background checks on people that they hire to teach. The other thing is that Mike Yaporsky didn't really have a criminal record per se. He had an arrest record. He had a municipal record, but he didn't have a felony record. He didn't have a criminal record, so to speak. Norm Hallman found it suspicious that Yaporsky had taken off kids' shoes and socks in his past. And you may recall that when John's body was found, he was unclothed, but also his shoes and socks were taken off, and the socks were tucked inside of the shoes, which is something that the police thought someone with an unusual interest in kids' feet might do. Here's Detective Schoonover again.
In interviews with other victims that Yaporsky had, he would take the shoes, he would take the socks, he would put the socks inside the shoes, he would lay them in a specific place. Okay? That was part of his thing.
Yaporsky took 2 lie detector tests on the same day. The first one was ruled inconclusive. They said he was having these emotional responses that were interfering with the calibration of the machine, and they couldn't tell if he was telling the truth or not. And then the second one, the results were very strange. The polygraph examiner said, in his view, all the signs pointed to Yaporsky was lying, but he wasn't 100% sure, and so he thought Yaporsky should have a third lie detector test, but he never did. So by the time they actually added him to the suspect list, he had made this huge career leap to becoming a scout for the Seattle Supersonics basketball team. So he wasn't a substitute teacher anymore. He was working for the NBA. He was living in Seattle. And he actually voluntarily came back and took this lie detector test. Here's what Yaporsky remembered about those lie detector tests years later when he was questioned by Detective Schoonover.
So that would have been the time in that last meeting then, is that when you submitted to a couple polygraph tests?
Right.
Do you remember those?
remember taking a poly, my attorney had me take one. Yeah, I remember taking a poly.
Yeah. Okay. One or two? Do you remember?
I remember one, for sure.
All right. Do you remember when they told you what the test results from the polygraph were?
I think the one with my attorney was inconclusive. I don't remember hearing anything else about any others.
There was two polygraph tests.
Okay.
One was inconclusive, like you said. The other one came off that you were deceitful.
Okay.
Which, in layman's terms, is you were lying. Okay.
The police were not able to find any evidence against Yupurski. Yupurski continued to maintain that he was innocent of this crime and that there was nothing in his past that should have led police to believe he was capable of such a crime. They couldn't put him at the scene. They couldn't show that he knew John. It was more of, I think, a gut feeling on the behalf of some of the investigators. That wouldn't stop the investigators from staying focused on Yupurski for decades, even though a secret fact-finding hearing back in 1980 had already determined there was not enough evidence to charge him with a crime. Basically, the police dogged Mike Yupurski for years and years and years. So many of the women he dated, the police told him he was a homicide suspect. His employers were told he was a homicide suspect. So after two seasons with the Seattle Supersonics and the NBA, the police came calling. And once the owners of the team found out that he was a homicide suspect, he got fired. Then he got a job coaching a minor league basketball team in Maine, the Maine Lumberjacks, which he did for less than a season because the police told his employer he was a homicide suspect. And so, again, he got fired. He really had a hard time with this kind of cloud of suspicion following him around. One of the things that the police did to try and get some incriminating statements out of Yupurski is they worked with a woman he was dating in Seattle, and she had, I think it was a 10-year-old son. And so they told this woman, whose name was Nancy, that Yupurski was only with her because he had a thing for little boys and he was after her kid. And so she agreed to let them do some surveillance, and she was going to try to get him to confess since the police couldn't do it. And so these two detectives stayed in the dark in the spare bedroom of her apartment, sweating for hours, listening in on this conversation as she tried to get him to confess, but he didn't. Years later, investigators would talk to him about the fact that they listened in on him at Nancy's place.
She brought up the Wisconsin situation, and I was kind of startled and felt that it shouldn't be discussed with her, and pretty much didn't see her again.
And in fact, she was discussing that case with you. And there were detectives in the home. There's a complete record of the conversation.
Right.
I can't say I have ever seen the police do something like that. I think a lot of times when the police follow somebody around that way, they have solid evidence. They have at least a co-defendant pointing the finger at him or something. But I think it cuts both ways because also a lot of times the police just really aren't quite that diligent. They might let a cold case go much sooner than 10, 20 years. In my reporting career, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. When Schoonover came in 2001, he was convinced that Yupurski did it. He was the main suspect. He had been the main suspect for many years. The previous investigators were convinced that he did it. And so when Schoonover came in, his goal was to try and prove a case against Yupurski.
We interviewed him for probably almost 5 hours, a little over 5 hours. We tried, frankly, every interview technique that we knew of, that anybody knew of, I think. We even hit him with putting the crime scene photos in front of him, including one of the victim.
Schoonover didn't start to change his mind about Yupurski until he got the call about Daniel Acker in 2009. when Schoonover discovered the journal and the photo album and the shrine in Acker's basement, that's kind of when he went, whoa, wait a second, I think I've been looking at the wrong guy. Because Yaporsky had not inserted himself into the investigation the way Acker did. And Yaporsky did not remain obsessed with the murder the way Acker did. Yaporsky had managed to kind of put the whole thing behind him. Since then, Detective Schoonover has told me he feels like he was plagued by tunnel vision, that he followed the same road that his predecessors had followed without putting enough independent thought into it. And so now Schoonover tells me that he believes Yaporsky is most likely innocent, and he feels really bad that if he's innocent, the police ruined an innocent man's life.
When he walked away, I was still thinking, you're my guy. You're my suspect. I got to get you to confess to killing John, because I know you did it. And it was several years after that that I realized that maybe he's right and I'm wrong. If it proves that he is not our guy, yeah, I personally would feel bad that we've basically kind of ruined this guy's life. Putting myself in his shoes, I don't know what to do about it. I would feel bad. And I would more than easily and readily express that to him and apologize to him. In fact, in the interview, the second interview that we did with him, I did apologize to him. Can I make it up to him? No. Can anybody make it up to him? No, we can't. What do we do with that? I really have no idea what we can do with that. And I don't know what he would do with it. Hopefully he is a better person than I am and be able to accept that. You know, accept the fact that I screwed up. I'm sorry.
I think I had an advantage over the police in this situation because by the time I read about Yaporsky, I already knew about Acker and the whole story that there was to know about Acker. So my take on it was, okay, some of Yaporsky's behavior was strange back in the day, but in my opinion, Acker's behavior was stranger. I found an address for Mike Yaporsky in California, wrote him a letter, and instead of him responding to me, his attorney called me. And so I talked to the attorney. I told him what I wanted to do, told him why I wanted to talk to Mike. And he said, well, I'll pass on the information. You know, maybe he'll call me. So Mike never did call me, but he and I exchanged several emails. As a reporter, obviously, my preference is always to talk to people in person. And if I can't talk to them in person, I at least want to talk to them on the phone. In this case, though, I can understand why Mike was reluctant to do something like that after all he had been through. And I also think that he felt more secure in corresponding with me in writing just to make sure that his exact words were going to be what made it into the story. Mike Yaporsky continues to maintain his innocence today, as he did back in 2001 and before.
I did not either accidentally or on purpose take the life of John Zero, and don't know who did.
For now, the police will have to rely on other leads to try and solve John Zero's case. Next time on Unsolved. At the time that John died, Elaine Samuels was an associate medical examiner for Milwaukee County, and she's the one who performed the autopsy on John's body. Going back and reviewing the autopsy, the police realized that there were a lot of issues with Dr. Samuels' work.
I really wish that medical examiner never touched that body, never did the autopsy on John. I wish someone else in that office did the work. The fact that that doctor left the office was a very good thing.
Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved.